Hello, Mormon Matters listeners. This is Dan Weatherspoon, the host. I'm about to run an ad from Sunstone, which encourages you to look into the possibility of attending one of their upcoming regional symposiums. Also, take a look at their website to look for what's going to be happening July 27th through 31st in Salt Lake City. So after that ad, we'll begin the podcast in the normal way. Thanks.
Hi. I'm Stephen Carter, the editor of Sunstone Magazine. Like you, I'm addicted to blogs and podcasts that explore Mormon themes, but I also want to be with people, the kind who are as curious about history, theology, and culture as I am. That's why I've been going to Sunstone symposiums for more than a decade now. I want to explore new ideas. I want to see Mormonism from other perspectives. And, I'll admit it, I want to have lunch with my Mormon studies heroes. Sunstone has some great symposiums coming up, including one in Berkeley on January 30th, one in Mesa, Arizona on February 20th, and our first ever international conference in Birmingham, England from February 26th through 28th. Some of our speakers will include Wendy Montgomery, Dale McGowan, Natasha Helfer Parker, Christian Moore, Lindsay Hansen Park, and John DeLynn. Visit sunstone.org to learn more about our symposiums and magazine. Come join us. It's good to be together.
Welcome, everyone, to another special edition of co-release of the Mormon Matters podcast and the A Thoughtful Faith podcast. My name is Dan Weatherspoon, and I'm the host of Mormon Matters podcast.
And I'm Gina Colvin, the host of A Thoughtful Faith.
We are excited to bring back Boyd Peterson and Patrick Mason. The proximal cause for this conversation of these great guys is the release of Patrick's book called Planted, Belief and Belonging in an Age of Doubt. It was co-published by Deseret Book and the Maxwell Institute, and it is a great book for those who are trying to frame Mormonism in bigger ways than perhaps sometimes the culture or your particular ward or your family dynamics or something really allow to do it. And so we covered basically a lot of the topics that were in the first five chapters of the book. And today we're going to work on issues and things that were raised in the last half of the book. I could tell through the Mormon Matters Amazon click through that about eight or nine of you bought the book directly from the last podcast. So thank you for doing that, not only because I get a little piece of that action, but just that you were excited about the discussion that we had earlier. I'm sure lots more of you bought it through other means and things like that. But I hope this discussion will also help you be excited, because this is an important book that belongs on a lot of shelves, and especially those that are in the kind of audiences that Gina and A Thoughtful Faith and I and Mormon Matters audiences. Is kind of, this is where we live. This is the dynamics in many ways of lots of things we do. So welcome back to the podcast, Boyd and Patrick.
Great to be here.
Yeah, thanks. This is fun.
Good. I'm glad you guys find it fun. I do. This is just the, you know, what better way to make a living than to talk about cool and important things like this and stuff that hits so close to home too. So Patrick, I hate to throw you right into the fire here, or not throw you necessarily, but I think the topic that happens to be the topic of chapter 6, which is called In All Patience and Faith, is particularly pressing right now. And we're speaking here about 3 to 4 weeks past President Nelson's talk in Hawaii to all the youth of the church. And what I would love you to do, if you wouldn't mind, is frame chapter 6 as what you see as the calling of God for us as members of the church, and even as leaders of the church, how we should, you know, what should be in our minds and in our hearts as we interact with each other as fallible beings.
Right. No, thanks. In a lot of ways, this was one of the most difficult chapters to write and think through, because this is the chapter where I deal with prophetic fallibility, which is a topic that as Mormons we have a hard time talking about, especially in our wards and branches on Sundays. We have invested, especially in recent decades, we've invested so much in the authority of the prophets and apostles that it's difficult for us to think about what fallibility actually means. But I think we have to. It's one of the points that I make in the chapter is, I mean, it's just embedded within our scriptural theology, within many of the statements of the prophets and apostles themselves. They do not claim, we do not have a doctrine of infallibility within Mormonism, even though culturally we've sort of created one. And so so I think if and I go through some arguments for that. For some people, this is like, well, duh, of course. Other people, this has been a tough chapter for them to read because they've never really thought about – they've sort of bought into a kind of cultural notion of infallibility. So when I talk about prophets' errors and flaws and sinfulness among prophets and apostles, that's hard for a lot of people to absorb. And so so my entree into it is dealing with the race and the priesthood temple ban that was in place from 1852 till 1978, but also going back into the Old Testament. I mean, obviously, many of those heroes and the people that we sing about in that primary song, "Follow the Prophet," which is an interesting song. We can talk about that if we want. But
you wrote a very good paragraph on that. You said you don't mind it when your kids are doing it when they're young, because you anticipate that being more nuanced and stuff as they grow
up. Right. And and for me, the whole thing, you know, there's the lyric, "Follow the prophet, he knows the way." I'm actually far more comfortable with that lyric if we would capitalize "the way."
Because it's Jesus, way.
Yeah, exactly. So I will and I think the calling is for us to follow prophets insofar as they're leading us to the way, the truth, and the life. That the prophets don't save us. Jesus Christ and his atonement saves us. And so the function, the role, the calling of prophets is to point us to Christ. They're not infallible in doing so. But I also think that that our responsibility as a community and when we come into a voluntary covenant within this community, part of that is entering into a relationship that with people that we believe God has called as prophets and apostles.
And okay, and so a little bit later, I had planned to ask you about the word "follow" anyway. Yeah. So why don't we just deal with it right here? So is that your answer to, like, okay, because we're going to be talking here a little bit about the Lord calling us to interact with them in patience and faith, but also you didn't necessarily shy away. A couple places later in the book, you'd simply say "follow them," and I was wondering is that your way of handling that? It's good to follow, but yet we have gained our own moral judgment, and we're able to decide to follow them only when we think that they're in the way that Christ points. Or
yeah, you're right. In the chapter, I don't really unpack that word "follow" very much, except what I just said in terms of kind of following them as they follow Jesus.
Right.
And for me, that is the basic paradigm that I'm working with. But it is it's a tricky question. I absolutely do not believe that we ever abdicate moral responsibility or accountability. So even in the framework of a covenant, even in the framework of being called to be part of a community, we never get to say we were just following orders, right?
Exactly.
And
the sin be upon them, should I follow them down the wrong path? Yeah,
that's exactly right. But for me, the interesting and really hard question is, what would I be called to do if I was in the audience when I heard Brigham Young say what he said in 1852, right? I mean, if I had the same kind of moral compunctions that I have now, if the many of which I learned from the church, you know, in terms of love for all people and charity, compassion, all these kinds of things. So if I had those same kind of moral lessons, and if I heard Brigham Young stand up and say those things that he said, instituting that priesthood and later temple ban in 1852, what would my responsibility be? And I actually allow for the possibility for different people to have different moral responses at that moment. I don't think there's a cookie cutter, and I'm not in the business of telling people this is what you must do, because I think it's an extraordinarily difficult kind of moral and ethical challenge at that moment. I mean, I do think
an important one for all of us to wrestle with.
Exactly, right? What is the role of the individual vis-a-vis the community? And when you think that your leaders who you sustain and uphold and who you believe that God has put a calling upon, when you believe that they make mistakes or make pronouncements, even in the name of the Lord, that violate your own sense of morality you've learned from the church and from the gospel, what do you do at that moment? So, I mean, the general thrust, and this is a pastoral book, and the way I live my life is that I don't think that the community and the covenant and my moral obligations can be reduced to only one thing. That I have to look at a kind of broader picture of what does this set of relationships in this community bring me and teach me, and what can I accomplish within it. Now, could I imagine a moment at which, you know, what would the breaking point be, right? You know, in which I say, I'm out of here, right?
I mean, which is where a lot of people are right now.
That's exactly right. And I appreciate that. And so what would that be? What would that look like? I think these are really hard ethical and moral questions. I do for myself. I mean, I can only speak for myself. I can stay in communion with the prophets and apostles of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints because I think that on the whole, they point me to discipleship in Jesus Christ, and they have fostered and nurtured my discipleship in Jesus Christ. I also personally believe that they inhabit an office and a calling that is providential. But I don't think that gives them some kind of stroke of infallibility. I feel the same way about my bishops and all kinds of other people who I think have been given callings. But I don't think that magically turns them into something that they're not.
Yeah, good stuff. I have follow-ups, but Gina, do you want to jump in at this point with anything in this area?
I do, actually. I just want to walk this back a little bit because I want to be clear about the terminology of prophet. And I'm curious to know from anybody, how did we come up with this community agreement about the meaning of a prophet, which has been conflated with followers of prophets? But I just feel that the very definition of prophet seems to be out of step with what the scriptures tell us about what a prophet is. And the way I see a prophet is someone who has been transformed, had a transcendent experience after having apprehended or have felt deeply the heartbreak of God, and they're lamenting in the wilderness for the people, and they don't appear to be patient. There's always this sacred and divine rebellion against what's happening in the now.
The status quo and
calling
both the wider society and the church to repentance.
Absolutely.
You read too much religious studies is your problem. Because you're basically, that is traditionally the meaning, and we in Mormonism have long been far away.
Well, I think that's the Old Testament too. I mean, I don't think you know, I think that we have not fully examined this concept of a prophet within Mormonism. I mean, it's clearly there. We didn't make it up, right? I mean, it's all over the Doctrine and Covenants, you know, and the calling of prophet, seer, revelator, and so forth.
But prophet president is kind of
right.
And
so we have not thought we treat all prophets the same. right? I mean, we think that the prophet is just kind of a one-size-fits-all, or at least that's the way we talk about it. But even in the scriptures, not all prophets really function the same way or come to their prophethood the same way or have the same kind of message or relationship to society and the people. Some are insiders, some are outsiders, some are what we'd call, you know, in the Jewish tradition, major prophets and minor prophets. I mean, you can't really say that Moses and Habakkuk were doing the same thing, you know, qualitatively. And I don't think that we can honestly say that Joseph Smith and frankly anybody else after him was really doing the same thing. I mean, I think they are, it's different, it's a qualitatively different experience of prophethood. And so there's, for class today, we were just reading Joseph Smith, Rough Stone Rolling, Richard Bushman's biography. And I think one of the key insights of that book, and this is an application for Max Weber, so here we are, sociology of religion, religious studies, is the way that Joseph Smith infused charisma and authority into the institution, into the organization, into the bureaucracy. And I think that's largely what has happened, that since him he was such a charismatic figure and was hearing the voice of God and providing all these revelations. I mean, that's one particular model of prophethood. But since then, of course, we haven't had that same kind of experience for our senior church leaders. But there is a trust that there's a kind of charisma or providence that's imbued in the institution and the organization and the bureaucracy. So these administrative callings still have a kind of charisma, but that's a different kind of charisma than Joseph Smith had, and it's different than Elijah, the voice crying in the wilderness. We just haven't teased this out very well.
No, I don't think we have teased it out because we're not taking consideration for other forms of sacred technologies which are embodied in the sage or the mystic, you know. And then there's the question of priesthood and why is seership like conflated with prophecy, you know. There's all sorts of questions I don't think that we've worked out particularly well yet. We're happy with the simple narrative.
Right, and so our prophets are kind of the consummate insiders, and they provide a kind of status quo stability for the church. It's a different model of prophethood than you see in the Old Testament, especially for those who are on the outside calling the structures of power to repentance.
I want Boyd to jump in here because, Boyd, you're quite aware of writings and things like that. I think you did one quite yourself that was talking about why the church needs to be the Church of Gene England rather than Bruce R. McConkie, and you've done a lot with those who've called Brigham, or the people, in fact, in your chapter 8, Patrick, Lowell Bennion, Gene England, you know, maybe Claudia and Richard, I haven't heard so much of praise there, but they're the ones who many have called being more in the prophetic mode of the Old Testament.
Yeah, I think we could add other people to that too. Hugh Nibley was certainly a huge, I think, prophetic voice. Gene England called him that in terms of his social commentary and criticism. And so, yeah, I think Gene is right. We have kind of conflated those terms. On the other hand, you know, I think prophets usually were calling people to do hard things. You know, I mean, very seldom do they call on people to, you know, go out to dinner and see a movie. They're calling people to do tough things. And so I think it's, you know, it behooves us to at least recognize when something we believe is contrary to what they say. I think it's good for us to reflect on, you know, could they be right? But clearly they can be wrong. And I think, you know, so literature has some great examples of how this kind of conflict between truth and you know, between God and your individual. And last summer, I went up to see Mel Leilani Larson's play Pilot Program. I don't know if anybody else.
Yeah, about calling a couple to practice polygamy in the modern time. Yeah.
Yeah. And that was one of the most painful plays I have. I mean, I came out of there just in just shocked, because, you know, she doesn't give you easy answers. You know, she shows this couple who really wrestle with this. And, you know, they both feel like at some level God is calling them to do this really, really hard thing. Likewise, she has a play called Little Happy Secrets that talks about, you know, it's two women, and one woman is attracted to her roommate, and you know, how do you be you know, a good Mormon and gay, and there aren't easy answers to these kinds of questions. So but at the same time, you know, Patrick cites these great examples of people like the Bushmans and Lowell Benyon and Jean England, who I think challenge us in really important ways, but also respond to their faith in a really deep way. And so they've all been examples to me. The one thing that is absent, I think, from Patrick's discussion, and I'd love to hear him talk about this, is pretty much all of those people also met with great animosity and censure. I mean, Jean England was forced out of BYU. Lowell Benyon was forced out of the Institute. You know, Claudia received a lot of criticism for The Exponent, and Richard certainly received a lot of pushback on his ideas about Joseph Smith and trying to be honest there. So, you know, I think this conflict is really good for us, but, you know, the question is, when is going along become complicit? When is, you know, how do we, and how does a good Mormon push without being pushed out? You know, I think those are questions that are really tough. And I'm not sure I have the answer to those, but I'd love to hear what Patrick has to say.
Good questions, yeah.
Yeah, well, I think you're right, Boyd. I mean, for me, one of the really impressive things about those four people, and actually one of the reasons I hold them up in that chapter, is because they certainly went through their vicissitudes in the church and with the church's leadership, sometimes very direct conflicts. So they each endured their fair share of criticisms for the way they went about it. And I didn't talk about that much in the book. I felt like it that just isn't where I wanted to go with the chapter. Didn't want to do kind of full biographies. Perhaps I could have mentioned it a bit more. I would have given it a little bit more three-dimensional quality than it has. But I think you're exactly right. I do have to say, I don't think this is not a uniquely Mormon problem or church problem. I mean, I think we struggle with this in all the institutions that we are a part of. I mean, I can't think of a single institution that I'm a part of, from my employer to the nation that I'm a citizen of to anything else, where I'm on board 100%, to the political party that I normally affiliate with. There are things that trouble me sometimes really deeply and offend my sense of ethics and morality, but that I don't walk away. I mean, we're as human beings, we just deal with this all the time, of remaining in relationships and in communities that sometimes offend our moral sensibilities. Now, you could say, well, shouldn't we expect the church to be and do more than that? And part of my answer is no. Why should we? Why, if we believe the prophets are fallible and bishops are fallible and Relief Society presidents and everybody else is fallible.
And we're fallible.
And I'm fallible, exactly. Why am I still holding the church as an institution, as a body, up to a really sort of unrealistic standard? Now, do I hope and pray and work for its betterment and ultimate a kind of Zion trajectory? Absolutely. But I think there's a kind of idolatry that happens when we want to make the church or any of the people within it a standard of moral perfection.
Yeah. Now, a lot of people who make that same point about shouldn't we expect more, also then follow it up with, but yet the church itself kind of makes that claim. It's kind of sets itself up that way as well.
Yeah, that's right. And I'd say that's part of the problem. Yeah, you know, right. I mean, that's part of the fallibility. Whenever any human being or human institution sets itself up, even with a kind of implicit infallibility, that's part of the problem.
Yeah. And you actually made a really interesting point in the chapter. I believe it's this chapter. It's somewhere in these five chapters where when Joseph Smith was screwing up and it became clear that he was screwing up, you said it was natural for his friends to all, you know, defend him and, oh, no, he's not screwing up and boom, boom, boom and cover up and this. And you kind of want to hold on to that perfection because it's you're protecting your friend. But you say, but our theology and our scriptures and everything said, it's okay to hold him up as making mistakes and things like that. And what a very different church we might have if we'd gotten in that habit of really looking at our scriptures.
Yeah, I mean, I think we got into this exactly this trap that we have essentially been singing from Eber Howe's songbook since 1834. Eber Howe is the author of Mormonism Unveiled. It was the first anti-Mormon book, and it republished a number of affidavits that had been collected showing how the Smith family and Joseph were a bunch of lazy ne'er-do-wells, this from their neighbors in Palmyra and so forth. So he was attacking the character of Joseph Smith and saying obviously he couldn't be a prophet of God if his character was somehow less than holy, perfect, celestial, something like that. And the response has been to defend Joseph Smith's character, which again, as I say in the book, I mean, there's something noble about defending our friends' characters. We do this all the time, right? But we missed the point theologically, and so we actually have joined the debate on the terms that Eber Howe set, conflating character and calling, and assuming that the two have anything to do with one another, whereas the scriptures give abundant examples. In fact, I think one of the messages of especially the Old Testament is that God calls people in spite of their moral failings, and he's showing his power, his ability to redeem history, to redeem humans, specifically by calling the weak and the simple. And that's loaded in our theology, section 1 of the Doctrine and Covenants, lots of other places, but we haven't normally gone there. We've gone instead to the defense of character and conflating character and calling.
Super point. Others jump in.
I think that's a really good point. But let me kind of go a little further, though, because so I had an encounter with Gene England when I was back in his ward, and he was my bishop, and he turned to me once kind of in private, just, you know, we were talking among a group of friends, and he just looked at me and said, what would you do if a general authority told you not to publish a journal, and yet the Spirit of God told you to do it? Now, obviously, he was talking about
dialogue, which you're now the editor of.
So this is something where he obviously went with his integrity, the feeling that he had within himself to push, you know, and again, that push constantly seemed to get him in trouble, probably more than the other examples that you listed. And yet that moral voice of his, I think, was so profound and important that, you know, today I think Gene really had a vision of the future, like I said in that article you mentioned, that we can emulate and we should emulate. And it would be really great if general authorities got on board and started, you know, recognizing that he has some answers to some of our questions, or at least a way to deal with them. But you know, I mean, that how does a person like us who may be a little bit outside of the box, I mean, it's one thing to say remain in the box, right? To stay there, but how do we help change that box? How do we make that box a little bigger without getting kicked out of it?
What did Gene do?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. He published Dialogue.
Right. I mean, he refused to let himself get bullied out of the church.
Yeah.
And he, I think he and Bunyan and the Bushmans, and we could go down lots of people, yeah. Hugh Nibley and others, Boyd Peterson, go down the list, have refused to get bullied out and have had transformative effects from the inside.
And I want to say something about that, because you're looking at a different cadre of people, aren't you? I mean, all of them are transformative and important of their workers. They're all Wasatch Front. You know, they're largely white and they're largely male. They've got relationships. They've got relationships through either BYU or they've got relationships with general authorities. Now, if you push that out a little bit, there are structural problems in that women don't have the same influence to create transformation. Look at Kate. She gets excommunicated. She asks for the priesthood. You push that out even further and there is a deafness to any of the I want to make a point about history, and a lot of our history comes out, a lot of our theology, Mormon theology, comes out of our history. But it's a particular, it's a rarefied kind of history. It's an American history. It's a Western United States history. But the church is bigger than America. So what happens if we take our theology out of a different place? So the point that I'm making is that I think we're paying lip service to the notion that, you know, the church... I mean, the church very, very poorly balances diverse interests or cultural rights or other voices very, very poorly. And the stranger you are, and you are going to be strange by virtue of your gender or your sexuality or your national origins, the worse it falls, you know, the harsher it falls on the ears at the centre. So, yes, I agree. The Bunyan... Gene, they could make these transformative statements that may be looked at, but they are one particular cadre, and our church is much, much bigger and much more complex than those amazing human beings.
I think that's exactly right, and so that modeled what they offered was a particular kind of mid to late 20th century model, where still the power and demographics of the church resided more or less in the Wasatch Front. Of course, the Bushmans have not spent most of their life in the Wasatch Front, but they're certainly in the inner circle. But this is the challenge facing the 21st century church. And first of all, will we allow it to be decentered in any way? How to apply those kinds of lessons? Which of those lessons apply to the 21st century church, or maybe do there need to be new scripts altogether, new strategies and new tactics devised by those of you, as you say, who feel marginalized and are because of gender, sexuality, national origin, race, and any number of other things, ideology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe there needs to be a new prophetic tradition as well.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Gene necessarily had a script to follow. I mean, he sort of had to make it up as he went along, and so I think we can't as much as I want to honor their legacy, and that's why I lift them up in that chapter. I think we have to come up with our own scripts in the 21st century.
Mm-hmm. And Gina, in many ways, that's what you're doing out there as a voice from the Antipodes. You know, you're being a prophetic call out there. So I'm grateful for what you're doing and the questions you raise.
Well, I wish, you know, there were more. I wish that we could all throw these voices, these diverse voices, into the pot and see what we come out with. I mean, I think that is the work of prophecy and seership and revelation, to take our ambiguities, to take our chaos and our mess and say, how does this reflect the gospel of Jesus Christ? How can we get a narrative that fits all people?
Awesome.
Not just a few.
And what you just said there about how does this fit the gospel of Jesus Christ, the discussion moved on a little bit past me, but one of my observations of Gene England from having, you know, collected everything I'm the web guy for the EugeneEngland.org website, and, you know, collecting lots of different things of his, and reading especially his stuff in the 60s and 70s, Boyd and Patrick, you might really remember this, Gene throws out all these crazy ideas in terms of, like, here's how you solve the problem in Vietnam, and here's how you solve, you know, this and that and the other thing. And none of it seems like it makes a whole lot of practical sense, but every single one of them was purely gospel of Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. You know, why don't mm-hmm. we actually give Christianity a try? Why don't we right. actually go and talk to people rather than bomb them? Why don't we feed them instead of, you know, with these blockades and these sanctions and things like this? And I would read it with almost like, oh, Gene, you're so naive and stuff like that. But it just dawned on me, you know, prophets aren't supposed to be politicians. They're not supposed to be the guys that make it, you know, make the policy and actually do it. But they're the ones that put the radical ideals out there that we do our best, and we hold those things out there as a magnet and as a draw and as a sun to aim for while the rest is made. And that's what a prophet really can do. And that's why I totally embrace that label for yeah. Gene and those guys.
And I think so. And I think one of the things that I was just speaking to Russ Osmond, and I think, you know, and he's somebody who's, you know, manages change and it swims in paradox and manages contradiction. And one of the things that he said is all of these contradictions can be solved by one question: how do we make everybody succeed in this? How do we make everybody feel loved in this?
Nice. Yeah, and that's
it's going to come
the
back
gospel
to that.
Of Jesus Christ. Yeah, and then one other little point about Christianity, because Patrick and Boyd, you both said something like, how is it that I can, you know, act this way boldly but not push too far and things like that? And how is it that Gene England survived it? And I think we didn't really quite say the reason he was able to survive it is because, like, you know, like the famous line about Brigham Young to about Orson Pratt, if you were to chop up Orson Pratt into 1,000 pieces, mm-hmm. every one of them still would scream Mormonism is true. The same thing with Gene, you know, his life and his enthusiasm and his things like that, you could not deny his faithfulness, for one thing. And then again, the other thing that's impressed me through just all the letters of his and the various things that I've read of his is when he had a problem with somebody, he looked at himself first and says, what's my portion of this? How have I contributed to this? You know, this, we've hurt each other's feelings here. What do I need to own for that? And his daughters told me that sometimes he'd fast for a day or two prior, but then he would always go right to that person and say, can we deal with this? And so, Patrick, you know, you tell the story in here about not getting a calling for WOW, and you find out later that it was because they were suspicious of your politics, and you didn't have that, you know, I'm sure you would have been happy if one of the bishopric members would have told you, you know, that, and you would have done it, or I guess in some ways you could have even said, hey, you know, I don't have a calling. Is there something going on? Let's work it out. But that's I really think, the secret. You know, just don't sit there and assume that we know the motives of somebody else.
You know, I think you're right. I mean, this is hard because I'm not very good at this, but I actually really believe in the Christian virtues.
Right. And that's a big one, isn't it?
I believe in humility. I believe in forgiveness. I believe in what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount. I mean, what you just described of what Gene did, that's exactly what Jesus says in Matthew 5, 6, 7, right? I mean, look at yourself first. Take the beam out of your own eye first. Reconcile with your brother. I mean, Mormons are expert at passive-aggressive and going around and not talking to people and snitching on somebody to the bishop rather than actually talking to him if you have a problem. I mean, we are – And this is just because we're human, right? I mean, you know, if we were to get serious about those Christian virtues, if we were to get serious about the Sermon on the Mount, it would be so radically transformative for each one of us. And in a lot of ways, that's what I'm calling for in the book in terms of our relationship to the prophets, you know, to connect it to what we were talking about earlier and all these kinds of things. The first question has to be to look inward, and our response has to be grounded in a deep, deep commitment to Jesus Christ and his gospel, not to the politics of the moment, not to our own anger, not even to our own issues or maybe even how it affects us personally, although that's going to play into it. But it has to be, I mean, Jesus calls us to really a very radical standard of self-introspection before we go out. And so I'm all for, you know, the kind of prophetic voice and all this kind of stuff, but that has to be grounded in the gospel of Jesus Christ.
Fantastic. Anybody else before we move on?
Well, I was going to just say, I think, you know, Patrick, you you paraphrase that little line about the church should comfort the afflicted and comfort the afflicted and afflict the comforted and
comfortable
afflict
the comfortable
I think you know, one of the things that happens when you're on this side of the fence is, you know, we go to church frequently and we're afflicted. You know, we feel that sense of affliction, and you know, I think often we need to learn how to be able to afflict ourselves, but in a way that is kind. You know, Gene had an essay that really affected me years ago, called "Speaking the Truth with Love." You know, I think it's really important to be a voice that stands up for things. I mean, you have to pick your battles, but, you know, I think it's really good to be able to be open and honest and tell people what you think. But do it in a spirit of love and openness and not just, you know, reaction. I had an experience years ago where somebody in a sacrament meeting basically gave the Republican Party's convention in our sacrament meeting talk. And I was just fuming, you know, I thought it's not a place for this kind of thing. And this person has stepped over a line, and I didn't do it gracefully, but I actually went to the man and I just said, you know, I was offended by this and I don't think it was appropriate. And he had no idea that he had done anything that would hurt anybody. And when I told him, he was really upset. He said, "I am so sorry." And that man, you know, he went into every priesthood quorum, every young adult class, he went into the Relief Society, the Sunday school classes, every class after that, and just said, "I know I've offended one person, and I may have offended others, and I just want to apologize."
Wow.
Good for him.
And I thought, you know, that is so... I mean, we became really great friends, you know, and we were different, but I had afflicted him and he needed to hear it. But, you know, I think the sense of being a loyal, you know, being loyal to the church, being loyal to each other, doesn't necessarily mean shutting up and just going along. You know, I think we need to be honest and open and share our real stuff, but again, speak that truth with love and humility and assume that people, I mean, more often than not, we make assumptions that are wrong. Zina was once released from the young women's, she was a counselor in the young women's, and she assumed it was because she was this liberal, you know, she was in graduate school at the time, and she just figured, you know, the bishop doesn't trust me to talk to these young women, and in fact, she found out that the bishop had released her because he knew she was going through a particular difficult time at grad school and needed more time and felt like that calling was just too much for her at the moment. And so, you know, you just it's so easy to get offended and you know, assume bad motives and I think it's important to assume good motives and just stupidity when you're offended most of the time, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, Patrick, I'm going to drive us back a little bit to a couple more things in the chapter. The DNC section that you know, it's from section 21 of the DNC, and which you would note is the very first revelation actually given as far as chronologically. Mm-hmm. And give the phrase there in the context of that, and then I want to talk about. You know, it talks about, and it sounds like it's a one-way street. We're to look upon our prophets and our leaders and have patience and faith with them and their fallibility and their weakness and things like that. But I do want to talk about how it needs to be a two-way street as well. So would you go ahead and quickly just, you know, get us into that scripture and
Yeah, so the scripture, so this is section 21, which is the revelation given on the day that the church was organized. So it was the first revelation to the Church of Christ.
That's
as
right.
It was organized.
Yeah, 'cause there's some 1828s, yeah, okay.
Yeah, right, okay. So there's earlier revelations, but this is to the organized church. And the verse, and at first it says, there will be a record kept among you, so historians always like that. Actually, the first commandment of the church is to keep a record. But then it says, wherefore, meaning the church, thou shalt give heed unto all his, meaning the prophet's, words and commandments, which he shall give unto you as he receiveth them, walking in all holiness before me. For his word ye shall receive, as if from mine own mouth, in all patience and faith. And Terrell and Fiona and Givens have picked up on this as well, and I have. Of course, we're really good at the faith part of it, but the patience part is interesting. and it seems, or at least it suggests to me, it suggests to Fiona and Terrell as well, that there is cause, you know, to have patience for this prophet who the Lord has just endorsed and says what he's going to say as if from mine own mouth. I mean, it's a very strong statement, but still this sense of having patience for it. And so I do talk a lot about what that means for us to do. But I think it's a great question to ask, Dan, about what does it mean on the other side? And I do think that obviously there's a huge moral burden on the prophets and apostles themselves. They operate under perhaps even more of a burden. I mean, the sense of where much is given, much is expected. I mean, that the degree of our accountability is commensurate with the degree of responsibility given to us. And so I think, but this goes back to the Christian virtues and the Sermon on the Mount, that I'm not their judge. Jesus calls me to forgive, and this is in the section, and I cite this in the section of the Doctrine and Covenants, where when we cite this all the time, where God says, you know, I call on you to forgive all people, to forgive everybody. In the exact, you know, I, the Lord, forgive sons unto those who confess their sins before me and ask forgiveness. Wherefore I say unto you that ye ought to forgive one another, for he that forgiveth not his brother trespasses, his brother's trespasses standeth condemned before the Lord. In that exact same section, the Lord had called out Joseph Smith's sin. This is section 64. And so the call for us to forgive all people of their trespasses is given immediately on the heels of the Lord calling out Joseph Smith's sins. And so my calling as a Christian, my first calling as a Christian, is to forgive and to recognize that God is the judge of me, God is the judge of the prophet, God is the judge of us all. And now, forgiveness is not cheap. We can talk a lot about forgiveness. What does that mean? I don't think it means looking the other way. In fact, I think forgiveness means staring straight in the face of evil and saying, no, it will not win. So we can talk a lot about forgiveness. But I really believe that if we're going to adopt the Christian virtues, that our calling is to forgive, and the prophet has accountability for his actions, and we have to respect that. I mean, I don't know what else to say about that. I cannot change what a prophet says or does, or a bishop. A bishop I'm a little closer to. I mean, this is part of the structural problem, and Gina's right in addressing this. So many of us are so distant from the prophets and apostles, we can't go to them. In fact, they've shut down lines of communication. They say, don't write to us, write to your stake president, right? And so there's no way. I actually can't fulfill the Sermon on the Mount in going to my brother, the prophet or apostle, to talk about how I've been offended. I can't. Structurally, institutionally, they've shut that down. And so that's tough, and it means they don't always hear, perhaps, how they've offended people. They're insulated from some of the accountability and maybe some of the pain that the people feel, and that's something we have to deal with in terms of our institutional culture of leadership. I think it represents a real problem for us moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Gina, that question actually was from you. Did I hit hard enough, or would you like to keep pushing on, you know, the two-way street of this patience and faith?
I would, because I want to understand what you mean by forgive, Patrick.
I think I have the, I'm called to demonstrate grace towards these people, to put them in the hands of God and in the hands of Christ, and not to exercise final judgment on their souls. I'm called to forgive is not to excuse. It's not to look the other way.
Not to stay silent.
It doesn't exactly. It's not to be silent or be silenced. But I think it's two things. It is a willingness to let God be the judge and let Christ's atonement do its work. And then second of all, not to be held captive by the harm that's been inflicted, to make the moral decision that my moral universe won't be entirely defined by them. And there's lots of people, and I know that this sounds so cheap, it sounds so easy, but my thinking about forgiveness is actually really deeply informed by the voices of victims in Rwanda, in South Africa, after the Holocaust. All these people who have been done tremendous harms, real victims, and are able to come out and talk with profound, you know, Nelson Mandela talking about, and Desmond Tutu and others talking about forgiveness, that there has to be an element of justice, and within whatever spheres that they can work for that kind of justice. But the, you know, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, they one of the geniuses of that, and of course there's plenty of, there's critics of it, but they said, in order for us to move forward as a society, we can't be stuck in a cycle of recriminations. That the majority of the victims said, we're going to offer forgiveness. Those people have got to stand before God. Those people have got to, but I'm not going to be held captive to the moral calculation that they created with their harm or with whatever they did. I think that's what forgiveness does. It frees the forgiver and leaves the perpetrator to work things out between themselves and God. There's a lot more that could be said about this, obviously, but that's what I'm informed by, is these kinds of those examples of forgiveness that go way beyond just a kind of cheap forgiveness.
Do you think that perhaps we might be crippled by our binary thinking to imagine then that forgiveness is just to let people off the hook, to rise above us and, you know, spread love bugs everywhere? Because it doesn't strike me, and I agree with you, Patrick, I agree that, you know, anger and hatred does callous the soul. And so what if we said, what you have done is wrong and it's been harmful, and I will leave you to the judgment of God, but I cannot leave the harm that you have done. I'm called upon as a Christian to deal with what you have left.
To forgive the perpetrator is not to excuse the sin or the harm done, right? It is not to look the other way and say, no harm, no foul, right? I think actually a robust sense of forgiveness is exactly the opposite. It is to recognize and come to terms with the depth of the sin, but to dissociate it from the perpetrator, or at least not to link it only and exclusively with the perpetrator. And so this is what Martin Luther King talked about all the time, and in the civil rights movement, he talked about that African Americans in the South had to forgive whites. And of course, Martin Luther King, nobody could accuse him of looking the other way at injustice and the things that were done. But he says, in order for us to move forward, if we want to be part of what he called the beloved community, we're all in this together. This is the same thing that South Africans reconcile. We don't get to separate from one another. Blacks and whites, we got to figure out a way to live with one another after the fact. And so if we're going to do this, if we're going to create the beloved community, we have to deal with the evils, with the actual sins, but not link them necessarily to the perpetrators and put such a heavy chain on them and essentially just turn the tables where the victims become a new kind and a new class of perpetrators, grinding the faces of those who had once done harm to them. So forgiveness creates an entirely different dynamic, social, political, and I would say religious and even ecclesiastical dynamic as well.
Mm. What if we put this into a contemporary context? Now, there are a lot of women that are increasingly arguing, actually, this inequality in power and authority in the church is actually a harm. It's very, very painful. We don't want to see that visited on further women, and we certainly don't want to see that on the generations of girl children coming through the church.
Right.
I can forgive you because I know that you as a male is constructed within this patriarchy. You've earned privileges from this patriarchy. Yet, and I will release that to God's judgment. What for you would look like, you know, work on the ground, the dusty, dirty work on the ground to actually rectify this injustice?
Well, one of the things I like, and I don't know if this will satisfy you, but one of the examples that I give in the book that I like, and I know she's gotten some heat from this, is I tell the story of Maxine Hanks, mm-hmm. Who was, of course, excommunicated for publishing Women in Authority and her feminist views, and then came back to the church 20 years later. And the kind of key for her is that she said, I used to believe that the church leaders were the problem, that they were obstacles that had to be surmounted, gotten around, or destroyed on the path to progress. She says, now I've come 20 years later, I've come to the realization that they're my brothers. They're not my enemies. In the kingdom of God, we don't have enemies. We have brothers and sisters. And so my job is to work with them. And so she hasn't recanted any of her views, any of these things, but she says, we're going to work together moving forward. I think that's a nice model. Now, it's still – what are the concrete things? I mean, I think a lot of this is going to happen in local congregations and wards, because again, what can I do about Salt Lake, right? I think we find creative and innovative and concrete things to do in our local context. This is why I like Nylan McBain's book. I know some people critique her for being too moderate, all these kinds of things, but I for one am comfortable with a gradualist theory of change, even while recognizing and saying that we have to minister to those who are in very real and deep pain right at the moment.
Mm. Talk about the gradualist theory of change.
Well, I think this is partly by temperament who I am, but frankly, this is also my read of Mormon history and sociology that generally has not responded well to what we might call kind of revolutionary movements or movements that demand radical change now. I do think that they have sometimes moved the needle in Mormonism, but they also at the same time create reactionary movements within Mormonism and within the Mormon leadership. So sometimes they can be counterproductive. So I tend towards a theory of change in which we work steadily and proactively, but also incrementally within the institution, working alongside, in participation with our brothers and sisters in the church, and doing what we can on the task which is immediately right in front of us, and essentially chewing the elephant one bite at a time. I'm just not convinced that a kind of radical call for change has ever been all that successful within Mormonism. Now, at the same time, and we talk about this within peace studies and political movements all the time. I mean, there's always the kind of radical revolutionaries and then there's the gradualists. Both sides have their pros and cons. Obviously, the flaw or the liability of the gradualist or incrementalist theory is that people are really in pain right now. People are being hurt. People are being harmed. People are suffering. And for every day that we delay justice, for every day that we work incrementally and admit that things continue to be done that are less than just, then people are suffering. And that's part of the moral burden that the incrementalist has to bear.
I think there's a physiological explanation, though, for the gradual change. And I was having a conversation with a woman who has been eviscerated in her Mormon community for her stand for women's equality in the church. Just absolutely eviscerated. And I think we pay like a massive tax for our vaginas in the church, really. A cultural tax, a social tax, a political tax. And I think if we think about it, our bodies, our bodies cease to give energy to something that feels so destructive. Mm. And as soon as we know, and I think many women are sensing this, I don't have any energy in my body, I cannot show up for this anymore. And so they take themselves out of the community. And so you're left with people who are actually much more comfortable with a slow, plodding, change. So, I just think it's physiological. I don't think that it's – I think we're losing people who could make a radical difference. And I see a kind of sacredness in that divine rebellion. I see that, we could be more called to that, to expedite change so that no more people need to suffer. I mean, Joanna Brooks, who's a very good friend, said, justice delayed is justice denied. So maybe we need to kind of have that conversation to marry up and make sense.
Yeah, and Joanna didn't come up with that. Martin Luther King said it, and other people before him.
She reminded me of it.
Yeah, exactly. But that's exactly right. This is the debate. And but you can... This has always been the debate about social change, and we can talk about this actually with the civil rights movement, with the feminist movement, with the gay rights movement, all these kinds of these things. This has always been the paradox within those movements for social change and justice. There have always been people who want change now, immediately, and there's a real moral virtue to that, but. The fact is that oftentimes those radical movements do create significant counter revolutions that sometimes leave things worse than where it started. So when I adopt an incrementalist theory, I'm quite serious about saying I have to accept the moral burden that comes with that. I have to accept that the justice is being denied for one more day, right, and one more week, and one more year, and one more decade. And that moral burden falls with me, with all of us. But I also am sensitive to the problem of counter-revolution.
Okay. I'm sorry, Dan. I've got one more question. Let's recenter Jesus in this. Was Jesus an incrementalist or was he a radical revolutionary?
I think both, actually. I think that he paid the price for his radicalism, I also think that he paved the way for a gradualist incremental. I think the Sermon on the Mount, even though it's a radical ethic, I actually think it's a pathway for gradual change. It's a transformative ethic that can't be achieved overnight. At the same time, I think his radical teachings about the kingdom of God and the nonviolent nature of the kingdom of God provided such a challenge to the institutional authority structures, especially the Roman Empire, but also the complicit Jewish hierarchy that was ingratiated within the political power structures. I think he posed such a radical threat there that he had to be eliminated. So he paid the price for his radicalism, but I also think his message allows for a kind of a gradual transformative effect on individuals and societies. So it's both and.
So then if we're the body of Christ, then we need a healthy way of being the body of Christ is to contain both the radical and the gradual.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, we also have to be willing to pay the price. And so you know, Jesus
did. Why wouldn't I?
Exactly. You say you know, what's the price of being a Christian? The cross. That's what he said. You know, if you follow me, that's what you get. You get the cross. And so I personally think about that, especially in the relationship of Christians to the political sphere, and that's what my next book is about, where I try to work out a Mormon theology and ethic of nonviolence, along with my co-author David Pulsifer. So I think that applies in the political sphere, but I do think we can think about what that means in the ecclesiastical sphere as well. What does it mean to go to the cross as we work within our religious communities?
Yeah, it does, and it kind of calls to question: is excommunication the cross?
Yeah, yeah. So
now, Gina, in some ways, I want to, there's a good transition into some stuff in chapter 7 with right what you're saying. I still want to play in chapter 6 one little bit longer, but let me go ahead and hint ahead for this chapter 7 piece. The thing that I think about the radical versus the incrementalist and the way that both can be healthy is, Patrick, you talk in chapter 7 about always abiding in the vine. Always being connected with the divine source, the energy of the universe, of God and things like that. And when you're fed by that energy, I do think radicalism can be more effective than when it is just, you know, throw it over, you know, let other people pick up the pieces of that's going to be left in the destruction of my wake, versus the person who, yes, I see the radical change that needs to be made, but I need to also figure out part of the solutions while I'm calling for the radical things. And so I think that when you are in the vine, meaning, Patrick, go ahead and tell me what you think. You kind of talk about the difference between being distracted by the branches versus the true center core of Christianity, I guess is what you're saying. I think there's something to that about that could inform both sides of what you're talking about, gradualist and radical.
Yeah, I mean, the burden for anybody who's engaged in social change has to be what is the positive vision that you're offering as an alternative, right? It's one thing to overthrow structures of power, but what are you going to and institutions? What are you going to replace them with, or are you just going to get now bottom on top, and essentially people participating in the same logics of power and oppression, or and then I think this is what Jesus offers is a completely different understanding of the way the power works, both in the Gospels and then for me a central text is DNC 121, no power or influence can or ought to be maintained, ... So for me that's the essence of the Christian gospel. When I say the vine, I'm talking about the life, ministry, teachings, atonement, and resurrection of Jesus.
Yeah. And then, Gina, I mentioned it briefly in the last thing, and again, it's come up in my podcast. I talk about, you know, abiding in that tension, the tragic gap. I like Parker Palmer's language and stuff on this. But his whole thing is if you are going to be a revolutionary, you have to make sure that your energy source isn't whether or not you actually succeed in making a change in the structure that you're trying to make, but that your energy source is this call from God, this, you know, this ever-renewing source of energy. And so when you talk about, you know, being eviscerated and not having it in our bodies and things to even do anything more, I totally honor that as a reality. I just don't know that that's a permanent state of being, and I do sense that there's, you know, what's needed is more Christianity, more, you know, going back to the source, because again, we can't tie our energy cycle to just whether or not we made a dent.
Yeah, and also we need more of sacralizing the wilderness, the place to go to renew.
Right, exactly, yeah. The renewal, the chrysalis, the cocooning that's sometimes so necessary, the recharge for sure. Anyway, I'm grateful for that. Boyd, have we totally like ignored you the last 20 minutes? Is there anything you want to say on any of this stuff? And I still want to go back to Chapter 6 just one more time before we go.
No, this is great. I'm loving this. I'm the kind of guy who wants to hear how rubber hits the road here, though. So let me make this real for just a second. I'm guessing that a good share of us, a lot of listeners to the podcast, certainly me, were very disturbed by the recent policy change.
That's where I'm going. I'm going there too. So you go for it. Take us there.
So, I mean, I can forgive my leaders for that. I really can. I think, you know, they're from a different generation. They're largely isolated from a lot of the, you know, outside stuff. That, I mean, I have gay friends. I don't know that most of them do. I have gay relatives. I don't know that they do. I mean, certainly one of them does, but not all 15 necessarily. And so, or they, at least they don't know about it, right? So I can forgive them, but what else? What am I called to do as a Christian? I mean, I feel like we have wounded the body of Christ here. I feel like this policy change is creating, I mean, certainly it's creating pain, and it may even be causing suicides. What am I called upon to do here? You know, I don't want, and now that it's been elevated to a kind of revelation as opposed to just a policy, you know, I feel like speaking out about it is going to call into question my loyalty to the church. And so I'd just love to explore that a little bit, because frankly, I really don't have answers to this question.
Let me add my little follow-up, and then we'll throw it open, okay? Because I was going to go there too. I'm with you, Boyd. It's pretty easy for me to forgive a leader, you know, for all the reasons that you gave, you know, and just that's just my nature to be kind of like, I'm screwed up too. Everybody's screwed up. Okay, we're all screwed up. I can forgive that. I don't have much trouble with that. What I have trouble with right now with this policy is, see, it was one thing for Elder Nelson or President Nelson to say that, and I could say, oh, that's a guy going rogue, you know. I could say that with Boyd K. Packer in the past. You know, even with the 1978 revelation, or prior to the 1978 revelation, where we kind of knew that there was a question going on for 20 years or so, we always had a signal from Hubie Brown or something that, you know, that, hey, we're working on this, you know, kind of thing. There's some freedom here. But what we haven't got right now since President Nelson's talk is any kind of signals that this was a guy going rogue. You know, he calls it a revelation, or he talks at least about a revelatory experience, but this isn't presented to us as a revelation. This was presented in a fireside. And I want to say that he's going rogue, that he's, I'm going to do a podcast here in about a week on apocalypticism. I want to kind of say that he sees the last days wrapping up, and he sees the sheep and the goats, and consequences be damned, because it's all going to wrap up right now. And, you know, you just act, because, you know, we're going to be proven right and all that. I can see all that going on there. But what I'm having trouble with, Patrick, and I'll throw it to you first, I guess, is right now the 15 are not signaling any kind of disunity on this particular thing. They let him go ahead and say that. They didn't take it out of the transcript. They went ahead and allowed it to be on the newsroom, the key paragraphs where he talked about it as a revelatory thing and things like that. That was the harder blow for me, is that we seem to have a united front. They're being loyal to their fellow Corn member, and I honor that to some degree. But at some point, to me, these number of lives being negatively affected somehow makes me want that 15 to break up, you know, this lock in arms kind of stuff. So that's harder for me to sustain in patience and faith when all 15 of them make the wrong move. Anybody who wants to jump in?
You know, there's in terms of what's actually going on in Salt Lake, there's just far more questions than answers, right? I think one of the challenges that we face in contemporary Mormon culture is that we really, don't understand what's happening in the senior councils of the church. Transparency is not a contemporary Mormon virtue, even though it is for the broader culture, and that's going to become more and more of a conflict moving forward. And so, I don't know. Does anybody else in the 15 disagree with this, or are they all 100% on board? I honestly don't know. I can't say. I do think it's so new and so fresh that I guess the historian in me says, let's give it a little time.
Yeah,
right?
Let's at least wait past April conference.
Yeah, and but at the same time, that this is where Gina's question becomes so important, right? That this is where the burden on me as a gradualist, as an incrementalist, really comes, because you're exactly right. Right now, people are hurting really, really bad. Maybe suicides. I mean, it's really hard, you know, to draw one-to-one correlations, you know, with this kind of stuff.
But contributing factor, for sure.
Contributing factor, it seems, right? And that is, I don't want that on my hands. I don't want that on my church's hands. I think that even if somebody agrees with the policy and agrees with President Nelson's framing of it, we have to reckon with that, and there should be a deep sense of collective mourning for any pain that this been caused. I think for people who disagree, again, out of a deep commitment to and connection to the gospel of Jesus Christ, I think there's room to speak out, and people are going to be vilified in local congregations or online or other things. But I think if that's what somebody is called to do, then they can do it. I don't see people being excommunicated for expressing verbal disagreement with policies. I don't see it. Maybe somebody has some examples.
Yeah, there have been. Yeah, there are some examples.
Excommunication for simply saying I disagree with this?
Church discipline, yeah.
But actual excommunication versus temporal recommends and stuff.
Not recently, but close to it.
Yeah.
Like, it's threatened, so.
Sure, and that's always, and this is where the church, that there's different dynamics of power. I think we can ask questions about whether the principles of Section 121 are being applied appropriately in those cases, where the church is exercising its authority. So let's keep talking about this stuff. I mean, this is why the Bloggernacle matters. This is why Dialogue matters, the journal. This is Sunstone and a podcast like this. We have the moral and ethical responsibility to speak. Can I change anything in Salt Lake right now? No, I just can't. Do I even really know what's going on in Salt Lake? No, I genuinely don't. But we can speak. We have voice. We have the ability to minister compassionately and Christianly to our LGBT brothers and sisters, to reach out to them and say, this I don't agree with this, or this doesn't ring true with my sense of Christianity. How can I show love to you? How can I make you feel like a child of God? And I'm sorry for any hurt that's been done. I mean, we can do all these things. I think when we focus all of our energy on Salt Lake, we're missing. We're in some ways abnegating and abdicating our responsibility, and saying all the moral authority and moral responsibility resides there. And even while recognizing the power differentials, we have a lot of work to do and can do a lot of work in our own spheres.
I think this is a good point, Patrick. And small gestures can often mean so much. I right after the policy change, I was deeply hurt, and it has affected my family in a big way. My son told my wife that he doesn't want to be associated with a hate group anymore, and so he's abandoned Mormonism. So this has had real world, you know, effects on my family. But you know, I've always felt really antsy about getting too political online or in the blogosphere or wherever, because I'm here at UVU representing religious studies and Mormon studies. Now I'm Dialogue, and I want to be a place where, you know, people can really come together. But after that policy, I just felt like I had to say something to my LGBTQ friends and relatives. And so I just went in on Facebook and I did, you know, the little rainbow profile picture. And I just put it up for a week. But the response to that was so overwhelming. I had friends who didn't know that I had taken this, you know, that I felt this way, who an old missionary friend who is gay, who wrote me and said, "Thank you, Boyd. I'm so glad to hear that." And another friend whose daughter is gay, and he wrote, and he's no longer Mormon, but he also said, you know, "Thank you for doing this." And I mean, that small gesture seemed to mean so much to people. I was really overwhelmed by it. I mean, it was such a little thing for me to be able to do, and yet it really seemed to make a difference to people just to know that somebody was there who didn't agree with this.
And to say, I mean, sackcloth and ashes, and to tell somebody, "I'm so sorry that my church has caused this pain."
Yeah. No. Exactly.
As somebody who exists on the outside of the periphery, I don't think you can get that much further away. one thing that becomes reasonably obvious is that contemporary Mormon culture is inseparably tied to Utah political interests. So we do know that this becomes important only when Utah is afflicted with some hard questions around sexual politics and inclusivity. You know, it says a lot about Utah and how spiritually impoverished the political system, you know, is, or spiritually uninformed, or whatever it is. It says that there is a disruption there. And what happens at Utah, once again, ricochets out to the rest of the world, and we're stuck managing a particular orientation that can, or a policy that comes out of a Utah-centric culture. So there are, you know, there are wheels within wheels there. So, you know, yes, it's one thing to say this calls upon us to be much more compassionate, engage with those people who are suffering. But on a larger structural level, it calls upon us to say, hang on a minute. Utah doesn't get to tell me what my national political interests are, or what, how I should be aligned in terms of my national political interests locally. And it comes back to that big question: what am I first? Am I a New Zealander first? Am I a Māori first? Or am I a Mormon first? It, you know, asks us to make those that do that questioning all the time. And I think it's a deeply troubling question to ask people who don't belong directly to the culture. So that brings out the less, you know, patient in me, because I think it's hard.
And then that's where diversity in the leadership it matters so much, because you know, yeah, people can travel around the world or have assignments around the world, but they don't, they're not from around the world, right? And
no,
so
no.
So it is a Utah and Western United States dominated leadership, and so those are the issues that, and I don't think there's anything necessarily nefarious about it. It's just natural. That's going to be the way they see the world, and those are the issues that they care about.
So. Yeah, it's nefarious where they come with their answers to questions that we haven't asked, and it's also nefarious when they never ask us questions in order for them to understand. It's not a dialogical relationship, and I think
right. Yeah. I think the outcomes can be. I try not to ascribe ill intent.
Oh, no, they're lovely.
Right.
Yeah, no, nobody's saying that as human beings they're not nice. I think it's they're just very
thoughtful. Blindnesses, yeah.
Yeah. And it's elective sometime, I think.
And in some ways, Gina, I have to say, you know, I've never lived in New Zealand, but I lived outside of Utah, and in some ways it's easier out there than it is in here. The Utah
sure.
culture can be so overwhelming, and I love Utah. I moved back to Utah. These are my people, you know. it's my culture. I'm a fifth generation Utah, and so I love this place deeply. But in some ways, it's harder to be a Mormon here than it is to be a Mormon outside of Utah, because those issues become so big here, and
yes.
It's so easy to get things mixed up. I mean, BYU is a religious school, and so you see how BYU is, you know, tied to Mormonism. But even UVU, we get, you know, this kind of Mormon stuff going on, and power structures here often reflect that larger culture. And I mean, it's infused into the culture. And so now, you know, if you had an LGBT sticker on your truck or something in Utah, you know, that you'd probably be driven off the road. Although it's interesting, I have seen quite a few Bernie stickers, even
Bernie Sanders.
Bernie. Yeah. So, in many respects, being on the outside of the church, being at the very periphery of the church, I mean, I'm reminded of my my adoptive father's experience when he was a state president. A letter came when they were encouraging homosexual law reform to decriminalize sodomy. A letter came from Salt Lake to say that they hoped that locally we would organize protest against this amendment to the bill. My father read the letter and looked across his councillors, and he said, "Brethren, how do we feel about this?" And there was rubbish from one person, not interested in another. He screwed it up and he put it in the rubbish. Now, you want to find out how to deal with Utah-centric crap, go to the periphery of the church and see what's happening there. Because mm-hmm. some stuff just doesn't fly because it's not based in the gospel of Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Cool. Patrick, you had some good things in the book about good experiences in South Bend and Cairo, Egypt, mm-hmm. about there is a dynamic there of, man, we're glad to see you.
Right.
If you're willing to put your shoulder to the wheel a little bit and show up for various things, we'll expand our views on who's acceptable to us.
Yeah, and I think it's really healthy. I mean, I was in Egypt in 2008 when Prop 8, and it barely registered on our radar. I mean, we never talked about it. I mean, it just didn't matter.
It doesn't. Just show up. Be part of the community. We'll love you. Yep. And can you take a calling or three?
Yeah, exactly. Three. Right.
Can you have 10 home teaching families?
That's right.
Hey, you guys, we've done what we usually do, which is talk too long on certain sections, at least from our initial outline. I'm going to, how about do this? We have about 15 minutes, and I'm just going to quickly highlight a couple of things so those who are interested in perhaps getting this book or who just want to know what's in it, I'll quickly do within 2 to 3 minutes an overview of the various chapters that are there. And then, Patrick, I'm going to kind of call on you at the end to make what I think is the largest argument of your book about, you know, why tension is okay, it's good, it's beneficial. Why, when church is hard, it still may be worth hanging in there. And I'm going to, I really think the last two chapters of the book are, you know, very powerful and all that. So if that's a good plan, let's go for it, okay?
Great.
Okay, so chapter 7, everybody, is... let me see what the title of it is. It is called Abide in the Vine, and it's a terrific one that we kind of hinted at, that basically it's the gospel of Jesus Christ. Take it seriously, and as you do that, somehow or other, something happens in you where you are able to forgive a little bit more. You are able to handle the tensions between authority and agency, or the call to be obedient as well as, you know, the natural, eternal, uncreated selves that we are and the freedom that we have to do. So Patrick does some very good and deep Christian theology there, especially on the Christian virtue of hope. And Patrick, maybe some other time I'll have you on, because I'd like to do maybe a podcast on the word hope and on that concept. But it's a very good chapter. Chapter 8, we've kind of hinted at a little bit. Patrick calls it The Church is True, and he basically talks about the different ways that you can say church, meaning this body of people getting together in relationship with each other, is true. It's not an emphasis on church teachings is true, though he certainly is not saying that they're not, but it's more the relationships between us and others and how we do it. And so this is originally in our plan was to have Boyd kind of go over the argument of this chapter, which is basically, it, besides Claudia and Richard and a little bit on Lowell Bunyan, you sum it up with Gene England's Why the Church is as True as the Gospel, which is because it forces us to actually meet new people that, you know, we can't be in our echo chamber any longer. We have to work side by side and learn to love, learn to listen, learn to get along with those who we normally wouldn't want to associate with, and how just it's a powerful school of love. You know, is what it is. And so when church is hard, that's actually part of the process. Chapter 9 is the chapter called When Church is Hard. And that's where Patrick makes that argument, you know, for a whole chapter kind of thing, right? Would you say that's true, Patrick?
Yeah.
All the different things. And you give little hints on, you know, when it's feeling overwhelming to you, try this.
Right.
Simplify, you know, pick one thing, you know, those kinds of various little, use the church to accomplish good things. I'm trying to look at them. Create spaces of inclusion, creatively work it out. You do some good advice in that about when church is hard. So I have a feeling that many people who are listening to this podcast, Gina's podcast, my podcast, church is hard. So this is a good chapter for you to take a look at. And then Patrick, the final chapter you call Embracing Mormonism. And this is, I guess, it's really just a continuation of that same argument. But is it, would you say it's the specifics of Mormonism that you think in some ways do it better or provide even a better school of love? Or how would you?
Yeah, for me, and the title is meant to be read both ways, both in terms of embracing as a verb. So for us to embrace Mormonism, but also as an adjective, that Mormonism should be a more embracing place.
That's right. Yes, you go both directions here. Yes.
Yeah.
Good. That's excellent. So that's the basic overview of the book. Now, Patrick, in my framing to you, I suggested that here's something I saw, and I'd love you just to kind of wrap up on this. I saw the argument, even from the very beginning of the book, it seemed like it would come up. We are eternal. We are uncreated beings. We have eternal agency. We have this compulsion, this basically the key thing of life, and you know, with Mormonism, it's certainly the key thing of the plan of salvation, is for us to grow and to be in more relationship. And all that comes down into the terms, be more like Christ, be Christ-like, to transform our souls and things like that. And so would you, you know, reflect on that framing as, is that really the driving principle of the gospel, and why all this thing about embracing Mormonism, even when it's hard, is that why it all fits together for you? And I'll just let you close with any kind of meditation on that.
Yeah, for me, I think you've hit it on the head that for me, the entire genius of Christianity and of Mormonism as an expression of restored Christianity is for us to have a transformative relationship with God. And that only happens through the relationships that we have with other people. That's all we have. And so those powerful teachings from Jesus, from King Benjamin, from others about the relationships that we have with one another are really what define the quality of our souls and the kind of relationship that we have with God. That's the only way, really, that we live out discipleship is in community and with one another. I think Mormonism, we don't have a monastic ideal. You can't retreat into the desert unless you all do it together. and so we have to be with one another. We're stuck with one another. And the paradox, of course, is that we are these uncreated eternal intelligences that have this remarkable amount of autonomy and freedom and independence. But that independence is only meaningful if we're interdependent, if we're in relationship with one another, that God isn't really God until he gets in relationship with all of us, that Jesus isn't a savior until he's in relationship with the saved and with those that he redeems. And for each of us, that it's a story about co-participation with God, co-creation with God. And so for me, the beauty of Mormonism is that it makes these strong demands on us, really tough. I mean, the conversation that we've had today, these are tough, moral and ethical issues. I don't have great answers to most of this stuff, but I know that for me, Mormonism provides a site and a laboratory where I can work out what it means to be more Christian. And so for me, it's the best laboratory I've found. It's the best one I've seen. And it's the one that's taught me how to be a Christian in whatever feeble ways that I am. And it's not to deny the virtue of other communities that are out there, but this is our community. This is my community. This is where I am. This is where, providentially or whatever, this is where I've landed. And so, I think there's beauty and power and transformation, as we work through these issues together in community, but most of all in communion with Christ, who really is the one who's going to transform us. So I think these virtues, we have to apply the Christian virtues better than we have within our community if we want to be the body of Christ.
Yeah. And there's just no way to grow without resistance, without pain, without struggle. We're called to a wrestle, you know,
it's a wrestle with our soul. Things,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. You actually did a whole bunch of good scriptures that basically show that is ultimately what it's about. And I think so much of us want to rest, and it's proper to have those times of rest and perhaps, you know, recuperation and regaining energy and things like that. But ultimately we know that's the only place that we can be truly, truly happy, truly at peace. Again, the whole, I've brought it up on the podcast a few times. Viktor Frankl has that great line from Man's Search for Meaning, and it's something like, peace is not a tensionless state. Mm-hmm. Instead, it is the state of active engagement in something that's worthy of the human soul or the human endeavor. I can't quite remember the language, but it's like when you find something worthy to fight for, then that's when you can truly be at peace, when you're aligning with the struggle for that. And I do think that that's what's, you know, I buy the eternal nature and the uncreated nature, and that I don't think it's just something that was taught to me, that you know, my happiness is tied to my growth, and my growth isn't tied to embracing more perspectives, and that my largeness of soul is where the largeness of joy can come too, you know, even though it's the stretch.
Yeah, at the same time. Exactly. The thing that for me is worth fighting for, is struggling for, is Zion. And the vision of Zion, it's not just a romance. It's not just a myth. This is what Christ has called us to do, because we're not just saved as individuals. We're either all in it together or not at all. And this is the whole notion of sealing of everything else, that this is, we are a human family. We are in it together. And so we have to have a transformative effect on not just our own lives, but on the entire societies in which we live, in our neighborhoods, in our wards, in our stakes, in our nations, all these kinds of things. This is what Mormonism calls us to do. It calls us to transform the world. It's big, it's ambitious, it's heady. Some people might say it's naive. I think that's the message of Christianity, is change the world and do it in the way that Christ calls us to do.
Yeah, and guess what? You're never going to arrive there, and that's what we got to make peace with. You know, we'll never escape the tragic gap. We'll never fully see it. Jacob Baker, who's one of your students there at Claremont, wrote a wonderful essay in the book called A Book of Mormons, Latter-day Saints on a Modern Zion. Have you guys all seen that lately? That Emily Jensen and Tracy McKay Lamb put together. And his is basically, it's like, this is what's going to happen. We strive for Zion, and it will always ever be out of reach. But it's the same thing that Enoch saw with God in Moses 7. You know, God's job is going to be always full of mourning for what's not there, and yet, you know, also the joy of, you know, having more souls that do come in communion with God. You know, we just have to almost like gear up for an eternal struggle, but yet that's the only game. It's God's game, And if we want to be as big as we can be, that's got to be our game, and we've got to be willing to try. But of course, you got to be plugged into the vine. You got to find that resource other than success or failure on the surface.
I agree. Yeah.
Could I just? I want to plug a review of Patrick's book that hasn't been published yet, and I wish I could say it was going to come out in Dialogue, but I think it's going to be in Sunstone, unfortunately. But Stephen Carter has written a really wonderful review, and he pushes, I think, Patrick's point a little further. He says, you know, tension is where creation occurs, he says. And so let me just read a little bit of this, because I think it's beautiful, and so you can all look at the next issue of Sunstone or whichever one it is in. But he says, so instead of saying I'm entering a period of doubt, it would be more clear-sighted to say I'm entering a creative space. Important tensions are becoming visible to me, and I'm centering myself between them. I'm feeling the strength of their gravities. I'm allowing them, however painfully, to stretch me into something I've never been before. I'm going to perceive through wider eyes soon, through a fuller heart, through an expanded mind, through an enriched spirit. Being a child of God, I'm progressing. And I stay in this church because I can create things here I could never make in a less charged context. I love that. I think
that's beautiful. Such
a moving way of putting that. And, you know, I think one of the points that Patrick makes in that kind of how to stay a Mormon is good, the idea of simplifying. But I'd also add the idea of complicating. I think I've known a lot of people who have found by bringing in maybe practices from other traditions or you know, finding more ways to express Mormonism in different ways that we've traditionally done. I think those are really powerful ideas. I know there's Ronan Head, I think it is, who in England has worked out a kind of liturgical calendar and liturgical, you know, prayers actually for a Mormon faith. And I think that's a really cool idea. I was talking with Ignacio Garcia today, and he's a professor at BYU and a really deeply faithful Mormon. His hero is Hugo Chavez, you know, and he was out at the forefront of Ignacio was out in the forefront of Chicano Revolution.
Oh, do you mean Cesar Chavez, not Hugo?
Yeah,
Chavez.
Sorry, the other one. Yeah,
yeah.
Oops, big mistake. Thank you. But Ignacio was kind of called to that by his vision of Mormonism. Bonner Ritchie, his experiences in the civil rights movement, you know, he was called to that through Mormonism. And so I think complicating your Mormonism can also be a way of staying. It can give you a way to make, you know, to do that kind of creation in interesting and new and vibrant ways.
Yeah, I like that because, I mean, frankly, so many people are bored at church. And Mormonism is so rich, so deep. There's so much that we're living beneath our privileges when we're boring ourselves.
Nice, yeah. You have some good examples of people who says, "I'm gonna dive in and do something with this ward that I'm in," you know, and various things like that. Yeah, create spaces for all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
Good stuff. Gina, what would you want to wrap up with if we turn to you here at the end?
Oh, I just want to say thank you to Patrick for a really great conversation and a really good thought-provoking book that raises lots of questions but also gives us a new language with which we can deal with some of the complexity. So I hope it's well read, particularly by bishops and stake presidents and general authorities.
Well, thanks. And I appreciate all the tough questions. I mean, I don't have all the answers, but I want the book, I'm really sincere that I want the book to start conversations, right? And for exactly what we've done here. And I hope this is happening in people's homes and living rooms and with their bishops and the people they visit teach. And I just think that the more engaged we are, with our religion and with one another. I do have this hope, this Christian virtue of hope, that there's something better on the other side.
Yeah, and my sense is that you don't want it to be a panacea for nope. all of the church's troubles. That you're more open to the question than the answer.
Yeah, no, exactly. If my book somehow became a painkiller, you know, or morphine or something like that, to put us in a kind of sweet but dull sense. tranquilizer of some sort. That would be a tragedy. While I do think that the book will be a helpful framework for a lot of people, there are a lot of tough issues that we're going to continue to grapple with, and hopefully in a deeply Christian framework. But these questions aren't going to go away anytime soon.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And it is a book really for the kinds of audiences that are listening to A Thoughtful Faith, that are listening to Mormon Matters, Mormon Stories. And I say especially the first two, because I would guess that for the most part, those who really engage with these podcasts are trying to make it work. And if we go back to the first of these two podcasts, we talked about different framings and just good reminders about history, about any tool and how much it can illuminate. And then here we now are reminded at all of these spots, just we've got to be Christian. We've got to be centered in the right thing. We've got to do that. And I just think that, you know, we can get so caught up in the, like, again, we didn't talk about this chapter, but you talked about the branches versus the vine, Patrick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's just so many places out there that aren't the real vine, and we're wearing our lives out, and we're making huge decisions, and we're almost forgetting that these are just branches of a vine, and you got to get the nutrients, and you got to get that stuff here. So it's a great book for, let's keep all our perspectives open. And like you say, you're not trying to solve it all, but you do just remind us left and right of the virtue in the struggle. So,
well, thanks for the opportunity to talk about it. This has just been great. So thank you all.
You bet. And Boyd, thank you, my friend.
Oh, thank you. It's fun.
Love having you on. We'll get your next book on here, and we'll have Patrick come and be the extra commentator.
But
congratulations and good luck with Dialogue as you start launching here pretty soon, huh?
Thanks. Yeah. Okay. This is fun.
Hey, thanks, Gina.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Welcome. Yeah. And thank you, listeners, to both Mormon Matters and A Thoughtful Faith. We hope that you will engage us in the comment sections at our websites. We hope that you will find those donate buttons, don't we, Gina?
We like that.
The support is just vital, and it means so much to us. It's not only money. It's really a neat affirmation to know that what we're putting out here is a value to you. And so we really appreciate you taking a look at those things. And let's just wish each other well. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dan. And Patrick and Boyd.
Cue the music. Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.